water. Stay away from fire coral and the spiny black sea urchins. Nothing else in these waters will hurt you. And after you finish your snorkel, Cash says, we'll open the bar. Cheers. Zach Brown sings Chicken Fried. There's no dollar sign on a peace of mind. This I've come to know. The day unfolds without a hitch. Cash joins his new lady friends from Wichita at Nigel's Boom Boom, where Nigel himself makes the best hot dog with griddled onions Cash has ever tasted. The ladies ask him questions that he avoids answering in detail, but they're into Nigel's rum punch, so they don't really notice. My first winter in St. John? I came down here to be with my mother after my father died. The ladies love this. He's so sensitive, such a devoted son. I used to be a ski instructor in Breckenridge. Then I lived in Denver for a while. But I've traded in my ski boots for flip-flops, my poles and goggles for a mask and snorkel, and I'm staying here. Yes, I have a girlfriend, Tilda. The relationship is pretty much brand new.
Well, Amy says, I hope she knows how lucky she is.
They leave Smuggler's Cove and head to Sandy Spit, which is half an acre of pure white sand with light foliage, including a couple of palms, making it look like a Corona ad. Everyone jumps off the boat to swim ashore, and Cash takes pictures with his ladies for their Instagrams. Then it's off to the Willie T, properly the William Thornton, the floating bar named for an infamous 19th century pirate. They tie up, and the nine ladies head directly upstairs to the bar and order the shot ski, something Cash is only too familiar with from the bars in Breckenridge. The ski has four holes for four shot glasses, and on the count of three, the ladies lift the ski to their mouths and do the shots in unison. Because there are only four shots per ski, this has to be repeated a number of times so the other passengers from the Treasure Island, including the inconvenienced Mr. and Mrs. Bellhorn, can take turns as well. The ladies want Cash to do the shot ski. It's a bar trick that never gets old. But no, sorry, he says, he's on the clock. He can, however, fulfill his promise to step out onto the jumping platform, 12 feet above the water's surface, and jump off while holding Donna's hand. Cash won't lie. He's a little nervous, even though he'd think nothing of a ski jump this steep. He checks in with the birthday girl when they're standing on the platform. Donna, do you wanna? He asks, thinking he's the epitome of wit. But she doesn't answer, just flings herself forward, and Cash has no choice but to follow. Shot skis, jumping from high ledges, what could go wrong? Nothing, as it turns out. It's exhilarating. Everyone loves it. Everyone's happy. The day is a resounding success. It's only after Cash has mixed up the last batch of painkillers and the charter is on the way home that he thinks to text Ayers. Missed you today, he says. This is true. Today went well, but it would have been easier and more fun with Ayers. You okay? A couple of seconds later, she sends the thumbs-up emoji, which tells him nothing but the bare minimum. She's alive. Cash is debating whether or not to ask a follow-up question. Emoji answers sort of discourage a longer text exchange when she texts again. I'm taking a leave of absence from the boat. What? He writes. Why? I heard about your mom, she says. How are you doing? Cash feels like sending back a thumbs-up emoji as a little screw you, because what does she mean she's taking a leave of absence from the boat? But what he says is, I'm living up at Tilda's, but today her parents said Winnie has to go, so I'm scrambling. There's a pause. Then three dots. Then, I'll take Winnie if you want. Cash quickly checks on everyone. They're happy, the sun has mellowed, Jimmy Buffett is singing Nautical Wheelers. If you wouldn't mind for a few weeks, I would be so grateful. Happy to, Ayers says.
I'll pick you up at the boat and we can go get her.
Ah. Cash feels an overwhelming sense of relief. Ayers will take Winnie. Winnie is crazy about Ayers. She's going to think she's died and gone to heaven. This is a good solution, much better than asking the housekeeper, Virgie, to take the dog home, which was Cash's only other idea. Cash texts Tilda. I don't need a ride. Ayers will bring me to Peter Bay. She's going to take Winnie. Tilda texts back.
KK.
There is no heart eyes emoji, her signature sign-off, which is odd. Cash texts, are you okay? He thinks about what Tilda said about Ayers that morning. She's newly single. But come on, Tilda can't be that sensitive. And the bald fact remains that Cash needs someone to take Winnie. Tilda texts,
I'm fine. I have a meeting anyway. I was going to tell you to hitch.
Okay. Should Cash be offended? Because he's feeling a little offended. A meeting with whom? No time to wonder because the boat is pulling in, and yes indeedy, the tip jar is filling up. Cash is standing in front of Mongoose Junction $310 richer when Ayers arrives in her little green pickup.
Hop in, she says.
She really does look sick. Pale, washed out, heavy-lidded. She's wearing cotton sleep shorts and a St. John concrete t-shirt. Stay left, pour right. And her curly blonde hair is a mess. Not a sexy mess, just a mess.
I hope whatever you have isn't contagious, Cash says, getting in.
She hits the gas.
So, you broke things off with Mick?
Ayers nods but doesn't offer anything else. Fine, she doesn't owe him an explanation.
How did you know about my mom?
Maya told me.
Oh, right, Cash says.
He hates to be a talker, but he feels like there's something going on.
Have you seen Baker?
He called once, but I didn't pick up, Ayers says. I'm not feeling great, and I need some time.
Right. Cash says.
He will stop talking even though he wants to brag about how smoothly the charter went. They swoop and dive around and over the hills, past Keneal, past Oppenheimer and Jumbie, past everyone packing up from a day spent at Trunk Bay, and then begin the climb up to Peter Bay. Cash speaks only to direct Ayers to the correct house. They careen down Tilda's driveway, and when Ayers stops, Cash hops out.
I'll go get Winnie, her food, her bowl, her leashes. Be right back.
He returns with Winnie in tow, and there's a bit of a long goodbye because although Winnie is going to the best possible home, Cash is still going to miss her like crazy.
I'll come see her tomorrow after work, he says. I can't thank you enough.
You don't have to thank me, Ayers says.
She sighs, and if Cash isn't mistaken, her eyes glaze over like she might cry.
The more the merrier.
The more the merrier? Cash thinks. He wonders if maybe Mick has left Ayers with his dog. That would be weird. And then he wonders if maybe Ayers plans on letting Baker and Floyd move in with her.
Do you have company?
Cash asks.
Kind of, Ayers says. I'm pregnant.
Maya. Her grounding lasts 6 days instead of 2 weeks, but even so, Maya misses the first meeting at the new clubhouse. She arrives at the second meeting early by herself. Everyone else is getting a ride, but because Huck and Irene have tripled up on their charters, Maya has to take the bus and then hike. The new clubhouse is very inconveniently located in the middle of nowhere, but that's the point. It's Par Force, the great house of the Reef Bay Plantation, and it can be accessed only by a spur of the Reef Bay Trail. Maya hikes down the trail, and when the three tourists ahead of her veer to the right to see the petroglyphs, Maya goes left up a steep hill that switchbacks up an even steeper hill. Parforce is engulfed in vines and coral creeper. The brick walls and stone columns are barely visible. There's a low hum surrounding the house that sounds like some kind of electrical force field. It's bees, Maya realizes, feasting on the pretty pink flowers of the creeper. Maya heads up the staircase to the main entryway. Unlike most of the ruins of houses on the island, this one still looks like a house. It has arches and columns and window openings, and the walls and roof are still mostly there. But, Maya's not gonna lie, it's spooky, even during the daytime, and she wishes someone else were here. They all agreed they would meet at 2:30 on Saturday. Earlier today, Bright had basketball practice, Colton guitar lessons, and Shane an orthodontist appointment over on St. Thomas. Joni is getting a ride from her mom, who's happy Joni and her friends are finally taking an interest in hiking. Maya tries to text Joni to ask if she's on the way, but she has no signal. In her backpack, she has 3 bottles of water, a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and a banana, so she won't die. But the idea of hanging out here alone much longer doesn't appeal. Maya's mother, Rosie, had brought her to Parforce only the year before. "I can't believe I've never shown you this place," she said. Then, once they were inside, "I probably avoided it because it's haunted." Now that Rosie is dead, ghosts aren't as scary as they used to be. Maya would welcome a visit from Rosie right now in any form, because where is everyone? She worries that this is some kind of prank, that while she was grounded, the rest of the group decided to trick her into going alone. Or maybe at the first meeting, they picked a different clubhouse location, Annaberg or Catherineburg, somewhere easier to get to, and forgot to tell Maya. Maya scrolls back through her texts with Joni. "Meet you at the place. Leaving for the place now." Snap, Maya thinks. What if the place Joni is talking about isn't this place? But then Maya hears voices. She pokes her head through one of the crumbling stone window openings to see Joni, Colton, and some girl Maya doesn't recognize all climbing up the hill together. "Hey," Maya says. She's relieved to see her friends, but she wishes it were Shane. Shane is a year older than Maya, and he goes to the Antilles school. He's her crush, and recently he's become more than just a crush. They have held hands on 3 separate occasions. Joni has a crush on Colton, but Colton likes Joni only as a friend. For now. Both Maya and Joni are hoping the clubhouse, where they're going to hang out without any adults watching them, will change this. "Maya!" Joni cries out. She runs up the stairs and gives Maya a hug, which seems a little strange since they just saw each other at school the day before, then gives Maya's hand an extra hard squeeze. It's a message of some sort about this unknown girl, friend or foe. Colton and the girl follow. Maya says, "Hey, I'm Maya." The girl has milky white skin, long red hair, and a pointy nose. She's wearing white shorts and a regular pair of beach flip-flops that show off her green polished toenails and silver toe rings. How did she hike all the way here in flip-flops? "I'm Lilibet," she says, shrugging. She peers around the dank inside of Parforce. "I'm in 7th. I go to Antilles. Is Shane here?" "Not yet," Maya says. "He had the ortho—" "Yeah, I know, but he said he'd be here waiting."
"You know who Lilibet's sister is, right, Maya?" Colton says. "Dusty. Dusty Beck."
Maya tries to hide her surprise. Dusty Beck is a bona fide St. Thomas celebrity. Maya, along with 12 million other people, follows Dusty on Instagram. Dusty was on the cover of last year's Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue, and Shane has a copy that she signed. He'd said he got it from a kid in my class.
which must have been the sister, Lilibet. What is she doing here? Cool, Maya says. Joni, behind Lilibet, has her arms locked across her chest and is rolling her eyes. Not cool with Joni. Okay, then. Not cool with Maya either. Shane invited you? Maya asks. Hey! They all turn to see Shane and Bright Whitaker racing up the hill. Maya tries to harden her facial expression, form it into some kind of shell. They created this club the night they met on the beach in Frank Bay because Colton was upset about his parents' divorce. Colton is staying on St. John with his mom, but his dad is moving back to the States, to North Carolina, the Outer Banks, and Colton will see him only half the summer and at Christmas. As they were talking to Colton that night, trying to make him feel better, it came out that they all had stuff to deal with at home and no one to talk to about it. That was really true for Maya. Her mother had died and a new family had appeared out of nowhere. So they decided to form a club and have meetings in person, not online, which felt old-fashioned in a cool way. They weren't allowed to discuss club business on their phones. They weren't allowed to take any pictures or post about the club. It would be a secret society, like the kind they had at Harvard and Yale. Maya didn't realize they were allowed to invite outsiders to join. She'd thought it was supposed to be just them, Maya, Shane, Joni, Colton, and Bright. But five is an odd number, so Maya supposes adding another girl makes sense. She had sort of figured they would discuss it first and vote. But this isn't Congress or Parliament. It's a bunch of middle school kids in the Virgin Islands. Maya decides to give Lilibet the benefit of the doubt. Maybe Shane invited her for a reason. Maybe her sister, the model, is addicted to drugs. Or maybe Lilibet is being bullied at school. Or maybe Lilibet's parents ignore her because Dusty is so pretty and famous. Shane! Lilibet screams. She goes flying down the steps in her stupid flip-flops. And forget the benefit of the doubt. Maya wishes for her to fall flat on her face. But she doesn't. She goes up to Shane and says, "Let me see." Shane smiles. His braces are off. "What?" Maya thinks. She knew Shane had the orthodontist, but she didn't know he was getting his braces off. Unfair. He looks hotter now than he did before by, like, a lot. Lilibet squeals and gives Shane a side hug, and Shane leans into her. They all head deeper into Parforce and wander through different rooms until they come to what must have been the kitchen. There's a giant fireplace opening. There are a bunch of piles of bricks that they can sit on. Shane turns to Maya. "Are you surprised the braces are off? What do you think?" She shrugs. She isn't going to fawn all over him like Lilibet. Lilibet is touching the columns, poking her head through the window openings. "This place is sublime," she says. "What's it doing here?" "This was the main living quarters of the family who owned the sugarcane plantation," Maya says. She gives an ironic laugh. "So, 200 years ago? Someone who looked like me would have been working in this kitchen as a slave." Everyone is quiet. Maya has made her friends uncomfortable, but oh well. The history of the Virgin Islands is uncomfortable. Lilibet says, "Maybe we should meet somewhere else? Do you want to pick a different place, Maya?" Her voice is concerned without being patronizing, and the benefit of the doubt resurfaces. Is Lilibet nice? "It doesn't bother me," Maya says. "My mom brought me here." She hopes that mentioning Rosie will lead them into the kind of soulful conversation that they had on Frank Bay, but nobody is paying attention to Maya except Lilibet. "Shane told me that your mother was killed in that helicopter crash on New Year's," Lilibet says. "I felt so bad for you. And honestly, you're kind of famous at Antilles now. I knew Shane was your friend, so I asked to meet you." Lilibet is here because of Maya?
This sounds like a compliment, but it also makes Maya feel like a circus sideshow. Famous at Antilles? Because she tragically lost her mother?
It's too bad we can't meet at the villa in Little Cinnamon, Shane says.
He turns to Lilibet.
Maya's dad? It was your dad, right? Your real dad that nobody knew about? Yeah, he was really rich and owned this huge villa with a 2-story pool. Maya gets to hang out there whenever she wants.
A 2-story pool? Lilibet says. Maya feels like her heart is being stung by a swarm of bees. She has confided a lot to Shane, but the things she told him were private, and here he is telling everyone.
Maya shrugs. She isn't about to admit that the villa has been seized by the FBI. She can't afford to be any more famous at Antilles than she already is. Colton and Bright are watching a YouTube video of surfing in Portugal on Bright's phone, and Joni joins them.
Maya nearly says, I thought we said no phones. But she doesn't want to sound like a teacher or a parent.
I have no service, Maya says.
To no one, because Shane is now telling Lilibet the gory details of getting his braces off.
Maya could join in and say, that sounds like medieval torture.
But she knows three's a crowd. She takes a minute to study Shane and Lilibet together. They're just two kids talking, right? Or does Shane like Lilibet? They move on to the topic of their math teacher, then to something that happened at morning meeting the day before. And then Shane relates all the near-death experiences he's had taking the shuttle to Antilles from the Red Hook Ferry. Maya smiles to herself, pretending to be deep in thought. If Lilibet is here because she wanted to meet Maya, then why is she talking only to Shane? Maya doesn't go to Antilles. She wants to, but her mother said not until 9th grade. Maya wonders if there will be enough money to pay for Antilles or college. Irene had said she'd handle it since Russ was gone, but now Irene has no money. What if Huck hasn't saved enough and Maya can't go to college in the States like she wants to? She feels like demanding everyone's attention so she can bring up this monumental issue. Her entire future hangs in the balance. But looking around, she realizes no one will care. Colton and Bright are engrossed in the video. Joni is shamelessly hanging over Colton's shoulder. Later, Maya will suggest Joni stop being so obvious. Lilibet and Shane are talking, and maybe they've inched closer together. Maybe Lilibet is flipping her hair for Shane's benefit. Here is the group the five of them created because they had no one to talk to about the important stuff, and Maya still has no one to talk to about the important stuff. She sits unnoticed for 5 minutes. 10. Then the boy's interest in the video ends and Colton says, this clubhouse sucks. There's nothing to do. Maya can't help herself.
We were supposed to talk, she says. Remember?
Remember crying on the beach about your parents? And remember who was there to listen? Lilibet checks her phone.
I've gotta go, she says. My dad's coming to get me in our boat in 20 minutes, and I have to get down to the beach.
She looks at Shane.
Do you want a ride back to Chocolate Hole? It's on our way.
Shane raises his eyebrows. He seems like a different person without his braces. Older, out of Maya's league.
Can you take...
He starts, casting his eyes around.
I live in Coral Bay, Joni says. Wrong direction. It should probably be just you, Lilibet says. My dad knows you.
Say no, Maya thinks. She and Shane can hike back up to the center line together. She'll share her sandwich with him, her banana. They can help each other up the steep parts. It's frightening how bad she wants this.
Okay, Shane says.
He stands up and gives the rest of them a wave. His eyes linger on Maya, and she looks down into her lap. She knows it's unreasonable to expect Shane to turn down a boat ride home. It's a 10-minute walk downhill to the beach. Lilibet will be fine in her flip-flops after all. And then he'll be back in Chocolate Hole 10 minutes after that. But still, it feels like Shane is choosing Lilibet over Maya. There are goodbyes, but they don't pick another day and time to meet. Shane and Lilibet race each other down the trail, with Lilibet predictably shrieking. Maya's insides have become crumbling ruins. Ah. But just like Parforce, she has a sturdy foundation. It's a nice thought that doesn't make her feel any better.
I'm leaving too, Maya announces.
Well, wait for us, Joni says. Yeah, Bright says, and he tugs on Maya's ponytail. Wait for us.
Maya backhands Bright against the chest. She dislikes anyone touching her hair. Bright grabs her arm and pokes her in the ribs, then tries to tickle her. She shoos him away.
My mom can probably give you a ride home, Bright says to Maya. It's not that far.
Bright lives on Gift Hill, across from the school. It's not that far, but it's not close either. Bright probably has a crush on her. He used to like Posey Alvarez, but that's over.
Maya thinks about how easy it would be if she could just transfer the feelings she has for Shane to Bright.
Bright is in her grade and he goes to Gift Hill. He's tall and he's good at sports, and his parents own a rental car company, which is cool because he gets driven around in all these brand new Jeeps in juicy colors. But Maya likes Bright only as a friend. Probably because she knows him too well. She remembers when he threw up during library time in second grade. Colton and Bright run up ahead, leaving Maya and Joni to eat their dust.
Hey, wait up! Joni says, Cole!
Her mother was right, Maya thinks. Love is messy and complicated. And, most of all, unfair. Irene. Because she no longer has a vehicle of her own, Irene joins Huck on his errands after their fishing charter. This means going to a few places. 1. Starfish Market for most groceries. It's BYOB, bring your own bag. Huck keeps a stash of reusable shopping bags behind the driver's seat of his truck, which Irene finds charming. Russ rarely, if ever, stopped for groceries, and the idea of him remembering reusable shopping bags is laughable. 2. Papaya Cafe and Bookstore for a Vietnamese coffee and a browse through the stacks of used books. Huck is a particular fan of the coffee, he has turned Irene onto it as well, and of Michael Connelly. He's patiently waiting for some tourist to turn in a copy of Dark Sacred Night. In the meantime, he buys a James Patterson novel, one of the Women's Murder Club series, which he says aren't half bad.
I'll take your word for it, Irene says. Why don't you pick out a book? Huck says. My treat.
It's kindnesses like this that make Irene emotional. She thinks back to New Year's Day, her dinner at the Pullman Bar and Diner with Lydia, followed by a trip to Prairie Lights, where Irene thought nothing of buying whatever books struck her fancy. Now it feels like an unreasonable luxury to spend $10 or $12 on a used book. Irene shops carefully. What will help her escape? She finds a well-loved copy of The Vacationers by Emma Straub for $6. She hands it to Huck. She wishes they were merely vacationers. Thank you, she says. Huck studies the cover.
Maybe I'll read it when you're done. Do you want a coffee too, AC?
She has stopped trying to get him not to use the nickname. She likes it more than she cares to admit. Please, she says. 3. Pine Peace Market for beer, wine, and a fresh bottle of Flor de Caña. Best prices. 4. St. John Market for anything they didn't have at Starfish. St. John Market is right across from the Westin Resort and timeshares, so it's heavily populated by fish-belly pale tourists buying groceries. It's to be avoided at all costs on Saturdays when families arrive for the week. Irene learned this the hard way. A few days earlier, Irene bumped into her own son at St. John Market. Baker was buying a jar of peanut butter and a loaf of white bread for Floyd's school lunches, Irene assumed. He had been too busy considering the ingredients on the peanut butter jar to register any surprise at seeing Irene. Maybe he wasn't surprised, Irene thought. It was a small island.
This isn't organic, he said, and it has a lot of sugar.
He held up the bread.
This isn't sprouted whole grain spelt or whatever. If my school wives from Houston saw this, they'd stage an intervention.
They'll never know, Irene said.
And she and Baker shared a smile for the first time in what felt like forever. Irene and Huck had also bumped into Ayers Wilson at St. John Market. They were walking in while Ayers was untying Winnie from the railing outside.
There's my grand dog,
Irene said, crouching down to rub Winnie's silky butterscotch head. Winnie's tail was going nuts. Winnie was happy to see Irene, but Ayers seemed to be another story.
Hey, Ayers said flatly.
She didn't look good. Her hair was unbrushed, her eyes puffy, her skin sallow. Cash had told Irene that Ayers had taken a leave of absence from the boat, and also that her engagement had ended, leaving her free to care for Winnie.
I owe you a huge thank you for helping Cash out, Irene said. I'm not sure what would have happened otherwise.
It's no big deal, Ayers said. I like having her around. Good distraction and all that. It gets me outside a couple of times a day anyway.
Are you okay, honey? Huck asked. If you don't mind my saying so, you look like death on a stick.
Huck, Irene said. It's okay, Ayers said. I'm just going through some stuff right now.
She frowned at Huck.
And I've been meaning, there's something I need to talk to you about later. I'll call you later.
Anytime, Huck said.
Irene wanted to ask Ayers if she knew that Baker was staying at the Westin, or if she knew Baker was moving to the island permanently if he could find a suitable rental. But she couldn't get into everything that had happened while they were all there at the store, so Irene said,
We're on the hunt for mangoes for Maya.
And Ayers led Winnie back to her little green truck.
Huck said, Did she seem off to you?
Yes, Irene said, but you should never tell a woman she looks anything less than radiant.
Oops, Huck said.
5. St. John Business Center. This is where Huck picks up his mail. There's always a long line of people who need to scan or make copies or ship something back to the States. Last time, Irene went inside with Huck. Candace, the woman in charge, asked Huck if Irene was his new lady friend, and Huck said,
Irene is my business partner.
And Candace said,
Okay, if that's what you want to call it.
This time, Irene stays in the truck. She has now been living with Huck for nearly 2 weeks, and everyone on the island must think they're a couple. Irene has far bigger worries than what other people think, but she has decided it's best to maintain a bit of distance by letting Huck get his own mail. There are still condolence letters about Rosie that arrive, and there are bills for the house. Irene has tried to contribute to the household, but Huck says absolutely not. And frankly, Irene is relieved. Huck emerges from the marketplace holding a square flat package and grinning. He's got his sunglasses on and his visor. He wears a navy bandana around his neck.
He's handsome when he smiles, Irene thinks. He's handsome all the time. He's strong. He's kind. He's trustworthy. He's honest.
But she's not ready. He comes to her window and hands her the package.
For you.
Me?
She studies the package. The return address reads M. Key, Iowa City, Iowa, 52245. Mavis Key has sent Irene what? Millie's picture. Irene opens the box, slides out the bubble-wrapped bundle inside, untapes it, unfolds it, and yes, there's Millie's portrait. Irene's eyes fill with tears. Mavis got it back. Amazing, simply amazing. Look, Irene says, showing the picture to Huck. This is Russ's mother, Millie, back in 1928 in Erie, Pennsylvania. Who does she remind you of? Huck takes the picture.
God damn, he says. Maya is her spitting image.
Irene leans back against the seat and closes her eyes. I'm going to give that picture to Maya. Thank God Mavis got it back.
There's a note here, Huck says.
Irene opens her eyes and Huck pulls a card from a corner of the frame. Call Nat, the note says. There's a number. Irene already has Natalie Key's number. Mavis texted it to her back on day one of the destitution. But Irene hasn't called her yet because, well, because she can't afford a lawyer, especially not a big fancy lawyer in New York City. And yet Irene knows she has to do something. She has been so busy trying to make it through each day, working on the boat, helping out around Huck's house where she can, checking in with Cash and Baker and Floyd, that she has been able to avoid thinking of all her worldly possessions in the custody of the FBI. If she ever wants to see them again or figure out what the hell is going on, she needs to do exactly what this card says and call Natalie Key.
I think we should celebrate, Huck says. What do you say we go to Candy's for some barbecue?
Irene places the photograph in her lap. It does feel like a victory, having Millie back. Maybe Millie will be good luck. Maybe Millie will help them. Yes, please, and thank you, Irene says. She'll call Natalie tomorrow, she decides. Tonight, she's going to eat some ribs, pasta salad with peas, and coleslaw with raisins, and pretend she's a vacationer. Before we get started, Natalie says, I want you to know that a guardian angel of yours has already sent me a retainer for $10,000. What? Irene says. Who did that? Was it Mavis? I'm not supposed to tell you, but I don't play games, Natalie says. It was your former boss, Joseph Feeney. Joseph Feeney, Irene thinks. The big boss at Heartland Home and Style. Mavis must have told him what happened, Irene says.
No doubt, and she probably strong-armed him, Natalie says. Mavis is tough, as I'm sure you know.
Mavis told me that you were tough, Irene says.
Ha! Natalie says. I guess we're both tough. We had three older brothers who were state champion wrestlers, so we learned how to get out of a headlock and a half Nelson at a very young age. Now, normally, I charge $900 an hour, but for you, I'm dropping my fee to $300. Again, that's at Mavis's request, and I always honor her requests when I can. So I'm really hoping, Irene, that we can get this done without any out-of-pocket expenses on your end.
Irene is so relieved, she feels dizzy. Thank you, Joseph Feeney, she thinks. You underpaid me for 12 years and essentially demoted me when you hired Mavis, and I called you all kinds of ugly names in my head. But when I needed you, you came through. Thanking him should be done by phone, but she can't risk the follow-up questions. She'll email. Wonderful, Irene says.
Now that that's out of the way, Natalie says, I need you to tell me everything.
Irene expects that, because Natalie is charging only a third of her usual fee, Irene will receive a third of Natalie's usual attention. But in only a matter of days, Natalie calls and gives her some answers. 1. The helicopter that Russ and Rosie took to Anegada was privately owned by Stephen Thompson, the third principal in Ascension. This particular helicopter had no black box, so there's no voice recording of the ride or the moments before the crash. Irene is relieved. There's a limit to what she can handle. 2. The people from Vizar, Virgin Islands Search and Rescue, told the FBI that they had reason to believe the helicopter was not struck by lightning, but rather exploded due to an electrical issue or possibly foul play. They are still investigating. The helicopter presently belongs to the British authorities because it went down in British waters. In theory, Natalie says, the Americans and the Brits work together, but after talking to both sides, my guess is that there's an intentional withholding of information by the Brits, which always has to do with money. The Brits will hold the copter hostage until they get some kind of recompense. Natalie pauses. Hard to know if this is all above board or if there's bribery going on. She chuckles. Actually, there's definitely bribery going on. Just so you know, even the good guys aren't good all the time. 3. Todd Croft had been arrested north of Trinidad and Tobago the same day that Irene lost the villa. There are a lot of charges against him, but the only one that they're presently holding him on is resisting arrest. Apparently, he gave the feds quite a chase. The other charges, Natalie says, might not stick. Most of the paper trail that ties Ascension to money laundering and tax evasion has Russ's signature only. A few documents also include Stephen Thompson's name. Although Todd is the founder of the company and the last remaining principal, without any concrete evidence tying him to the illegal activity, he might soon go free and, if his lawyer is good, he'll avoid jail time. He's telling the FBI that it was your husband and Mr. Thompson who ran the illegal business dealings, and he was involved only in the legitimate side of things, the soccer stars and casino owners who used Ascension to avoid taxes by residing in legal gray areas. He claims he didn't learn that Mr. Thompson and your husband had ventured to the dark side until September. Ascension is technically Mr. Croft's company, and he says those two threatened to take it down if Mr. Croft contacted the authorities. He cited the fact that Russ and Mr. Thompson were scooting off to Anegada without him as proof. And yet the FBI found him heading for Venezuela, where there are no extradition laws. Among Ascension's clients are entities that are into, among other things, narcotics trafficking, human trafficking, explosives, cybercrime, underground gambling, organ trafficking, and good old-fashioned counterfeiting. According to the paper trail, these entities gave their money to Russ, and Russ created shell companies at offshore banks in the Cayman Islands. He then invested that money in legitimate businesses on St. John and in the BVIs, where regulations are looser than they are in the U.S. They bought and sold a lot of land over on Anegada. They used SGMT, an offshore bank with a reputation for secrecy. That's the bank your personal finances were drawn on. Stephen Thompson joined the company only a year before Russ. Now, I did a little poking around on him. He was a British citizen, worked for Barclays out of law school, then disappeared for a few years, only to resurface down in the Caymans. But Mr. Thompson also held a passport from Suriname. Where's that? Irene says. It's a country in South America, Natalie says. They have a pay-for-citizenship policy. Invest $200,000 in the country's economy and receive a passport. That would have allowed Mr. Thompson to move around more freely without the oversight of the British government. I'm sorry, Irene says. It's nearly 7 o'clock. Natalie called just as Irene and Huck were driving home from a double charter day. They are both exhausted and irritable. I'm sorry, Natalie, but there is no way Russ was the mastermind behind all this. Irene laughs. I swear to you, didn't have it in him. Let's start with, we lived in
Iowa. Russ was a member of the Rotary. He was on the school board. He liked puns, for Pete's sake.
Underground gambling? Irene thinks. Human trafficking?
Russ's definition of underground gambling was the office football pool, and he would have thought human trafficking was something a crossing guard took care of.
He was a decent man.
I do still believe that. He must have been bribed by Todd Croft, and that was why he was the one who got his hands dirty.
Irene turns and looks out the open window. They're climbing Jacob's ladder. It's one steep switchback after another, and the engine of Huck's truck wheezes like an out-of-shape geezer on the Stairmaster. But they make it, they always make it, and they're treated to a magnificent sunset, brilliant orange, like a wildfire across the sky. The beauty of these islands is completely at odds with the news Irene is now hearing. Or maybe it's not at odds. Maybe this beauty was what seduced Russ. Irene knows better than anyone that once you experience life in this paradise, you'll do anything to keep it. Todd Croft offered Russ more money than he could possibly imagine, Irene says. Russ made $57,000 a year selling corn syrup. We were always struggling before he took this job. All I can think is that Todd offered him millions, and in exchange, he agreed to be the fall guy if they ever got caught. Irene swallows. He was that desperate, that eager to please me. I was hard on him.
Maybe it was bribing at first, Natalie says. But I'm going to guess that, as things progressed, it became blackmail.
Blackmail?
Natalie lowers her voice. If Todd Croft knew about Rosie and about Maya, well, he could have gotten Russ to do anything. Huck pulls into the driveway. Irene sees Baker and Floyd out on the deck with Maya. She can't continue a conversation that involves organ trafficking, and not the church kind of organ, while she's looking at her grandchild. She has to end this call.
Right, Irene says.
But we have no way to prove Todd did that, Natalie says. Yet.
Heirs. Baker must have had a sixth sense that something was going on, because he'd called Ayers while she was in the bathroom holding the pregnancy test with a shaky hand. Positive. Ayers had stared at the screen of her ringing phone. Baker was listed in her contacts as the tourist, with a photo of a leatherback sea turtle. She'd declined the call.
She was pregnant?
Well, yeah. Obviously.
Of course.
Ayers wasn't a complete idiot. Pregnancy had been her first thought, but she'd dismissed it immediately because it was too awful, and Ayers had had so much awful piled on her recently that there wasn't room for any more. Rosie dying, a broken engagement, and now? When Ayers got back together with Mick, she'd insisted he use a condom because of Bridget. He'd been good about this. Not happy, but conscientious. Even the night of their engagement, he'd used a condom. The only time Ayers had had unprotected sex was with Baker on their single night together. It was just that one night. A couple of times, but still. Still, that was all it took. One egg and one sperm. Baby.
Well, she couldn't have a baby. She could barely take care of herself.
She lived in a studio, cute but unsuitable. Her houseplants were dying. Where would she put a crib? A high chair? A pack and play or a bouncy chair or a swing or any of the other large, noisy paraphernalia that babies required? She could, maybe, have had Mick's baby, because Mick was a known quantity to Ayers. But to have a baby with Baker? A person she had been on exactly one date with and slept with twice? She wasn't prepared for any kind of conversation with Baker. she sent him a text. I've come down with something. It's bad, and I wouldn't want you or Floyd to catch it. I'll call you when I'm better.
Rosie had been in this exact same predicament. No, Rosie had had it worse. Rosie found herself pregnant by a man she thought she'd never see again. She'd kept the baby. And who was that baby now? It was Maya, the most wonderful human Ayers knew. Didn't Ayers want a Maya of her own? A child who was wise and sweet and smart and funny? A child who would love her the way that Maya loved Rosie? Theoretically, yes. Ayers wanted children. She had always pictured herself with children, and she even knew what kind of mother she wanted to be. The kind of mother who dressed up with her kids for Halloween. The kind of mother who let the kids have hot fudge sundaes for dinner on their last day of summer vacation. She wanted to be a scout leader. She wanted to be fun and involved and reliable, a buoy during the unpredictable currents and undertow of growing up. Just like everyone else, she wanted to be exactly like and completely different from her own parents. Oh, geez, Ayers thought. She had to tell her parents the news. But first, she would need to find them. Treasure Island was fixed, but Ayers couldn't handle an all-day boat charter either physically or mentally. She called Whitney in the office and told her that she needed some time off. A couple of weeks, she thought, but maybe longer.
But you're not quitting on us, right? Whitney said. No pressure, girlfriend, but you're the heart and soul of this operation. Cash is good, but he's brand new.
I'm coming back? Ayers said.
I mean, I'm coming back.
Of course I'm coming back. At La Tapa, Ayers was shaky and sweaty and distracted. Tilda covered for Ayers's lethargy and her mistakes. Tilda thought the problem was Mick, both the broken engagement and his week-long sit-in at Cruise Bay Landing. It had become a thing. Mick had been going to work, but directly afterward, he sat at the bar at CBL with the ring in front of him and Gordon tied to his bar stool, and he drank. He was there on his days off as well, from open to close. Tourists had started posting pictures of hashtag heartsick Mick with the beer and the ring box in front of him and Gordon snoozing dutifully at his feet. Mick had managed to make the breakup all about himself. He'd cast himself as the victim, and he'd gotten his own hashtag in the process. Meanwhile, Bridget was still working at the beach bar and not at Island Abodes like Mick had promised. So frankly, Ayers didn't care if 60 Minutes came to do a segment about his broken heart. Ayers wasn't going back.
I feel bad for the guy, Skip, the La Tapa bartender, said at the end of service. I'm going over to have a drink with him.
Birds of a feather, Tilda murmured. Ayers needed to confide in someone, and that someone should have been Baker. However, on Wednesday afternoon, Ayers got a text from Cash, and the next thing she knew, she had offered to adopt Winnie for a while because Tilda's fancy type A parents didn't do dogs. This, at least, felt right. It was the least she could do after abandoning Cash on Treasure Island. It would also be nice to have a warm body around, one who wasn't going to ask her any questions. Ayers had picked Cash up from the boat and driven to Peter Bay to collect Winnie. Ayers had never been to Tilda's fancy type A parents' villa before. She had never been to any of the homes in Peter Bay. It was exclusive, private, gajillionaire territory. And when she drove down the steep chute of Tilda's driveway, she got vertigo. It felt like they were driving off a cliff into the sea. Woo! When Ayers parked, her heart was slamming against her chest. She watched Cash as he strode into the house. Uncle Cash, she thought. My baby's uncle. She was about to leave. She had Winnie's leash in one hand and her bowl in the other, but then she blurted it out. Without intention, without planning, without warning. I'm pregnant.
Whoa,
Cash said. It's Baker's, Ayers whispered. Cash's eyes had bugged.
It is?
Ayers nodded.
You're sure?
I'm sure.
You haven't told my brother yet, have you?
Ayers shook her head. The mere thought made her want to hurl. She'd inhaled the scent of the frangipani bushes that surrounded Tilda's fancy, type A parents' villa. She needed to get out of there. The last thing she wanted was for Tilda to come home and ask what was wrong.
I haven't told anyone, Ayers said. Not even my parents.
That explains your leave of absence.
Just for a couple weeks, Ayers said. Until I get a better grip on things.
I'm sure it seems scary, Cash said, but I'll help. We'll all help. Baker has his flaws, but he's an excellent father.
Ayers wasn't ready to hear this. She wasn't even sure she was going to go through with it.
Don't tell a soul, she said. Not Tilda, not your mom, not Baker.
Are you kidding?
Cash said. He bent down to rub Winnie's head.
I'm giving you my best friend. The last thing I'm going to do is cross you.
Thank you.
I'm here, Cash said. And you know what? I'm psyched.
To track down her mother and father, Ayers clicks on the Wandering Wilson's Facebook page. Her parents share a cell phone and they call her when they're in a place with reliable service, which isn't often. Ayers's parents, Phil Wilson and Sonny Ray, have never married, though they've been together for 35 years. Each refers to the other as my partner, and they call each other my love. Their relationship is non-traditional and enviable. They have a shared vision of seeing the world on its own terms, abiding by the old adage, take nothing but photographs, leave nothing but footprints. Phil and Sonny met during a semester abroad in the Canary Islands in 1984. Phil was at Berkeley, Sonny at the University of Wisconsin. After that semester, they both dropped out and hopped on a freighter headed for Portugal, starting a life of wanderlust that has continued to this very day. Ayers's earliest memories are of walking between her parents down the dusty streets of one foreign country or another, the smell of diesel fuel, the sound of unfamiliar languages. Phil was the navigator. He had the map. Sonny was the ambassador. She did the talking, learning the words for hello and thank you in the language of every place they visited. They stayed in hostels or cheap hotels, Ayers and her parents sometimes all sharing a bed. They cooked in communal kitchens, showered in communal bathrooms. They slept on trains. They hiked and camped, snorkeled, tubed, ziplined, canoed, rafted, spelunked. They shopped at local markets, napped in botanical gardens, hopped on and off the goat and chicken bus, lit candles in churches, swam with dolphins and whale sharks, ate from street carts, bathed in hot springs, climbed to the scenic lookout at the crack of dawn, rode the elephant or donkey or camel, awoke to the call of the muezzin from the local mosque, swapped paperbacks, hand-washed their laundry, and hung it to dry stiff as cardboard in the baking sun. As soon as they stayed somewhere long enough to feel comfortable, they packed up and moved on. Ayers had seen it all. The pyramids, the Taj Mahal, Torres del Paine, the Galapagos, the Northern Lights, the Monteverde Cloud Forest, the Amazon River, the fjords, the glaciers, the mountain ranges, the deserts, the lakes, all of the oceans. That must have been so cool, people say, when Ayers describes her upbringing. You're so lucky. We all want what we can't have. Ayers wanted a house. She wanted a subscription to 17 magazine that would arrive reliably on the first of the month. She wanted parents like Coach and Tammy Taylor. She wanted siblings. Every week or two, someone aboard Treasure Island asks Ayers, "What do your parents think about you living on a tropical island?" The true answer? They think it's boring.
"Oh," she responds, "they're proud of me."
Ayers's parents have money now, inherited from Ayers's paternal grandmother, and so their travel has become far more comfortable. They stayed at the Shangri-La in Paris, which must have been interesting. Phil and Sunny still travel with large backpacks instead of proper luggage. Sunny wears pants and dresses made from khaki cotton. Both of Ayers's parents wear Birkenstocks. While in Paris, they had dinner at La Tour d'Argent because, as Sunny said, it was a classic Parisian experience they'd yet to have in their half a dozen visits to the city. Had Sunny worn her Birkenstocks to La Tour d'Argent? Ayers was afraid to ask. The last time Ayers spoke to her parents, they were in Morocco, staying with friends they'd met in Ibiza in the 1980s, before Ayers was born. These friends now own a home on the coast in Essaouira. All of Phil and Sunny's close friends are people they met on one adventure or another, hiking around the crater of Mount Batur in Bali, or shopping for an authentic Panama hat in Monte Cristi, Ecuador. That conversation with her parents was on the morning of Rosie's funeral, and a lot has happened since then. It feels like nearly everything important in Ayers's life has happened since then. A Facebook post from yesterday puts Phil and Sunny at Fairmont, the Norfolk, in Nairobi. A scroll back through their pictures shows they've been on safari in the Maasai Mara. Bah, Ayers thinks, they never took her on safari. They always said it was too expensive. There are the requisite pictures of giraffes, zebras, lions, elephants, and some of a hot air balloon ride they took at sunrise. Cheetahs, leopards, rhinos, baboons, hippos. A Maasai warrior posing with Phil and Sunny in their Birkenstocks. Ayers sighs. Her parents are in Africa. They couldn't be any farther away. Still, she tries their cell phone. What's the time difference? She doesn't care. She calls. Her mother answers on the first ring.
Freddy! Sunny says. Your timing is perfect. The front desk just sent us a bottle of champagne. They think we're travel bloggers.
She laughs.
I may have misled them a bit.
Suddenly, Ayers's father is on the phone. She misled them a lot, he says. Though it works, we've gotten free stuff every place we've checked in since your mother started referring to her blog.
Great,
Ayers says weakly. Her parents are in high spirits. They're about to open a bottle of champagne at a 5-star hotel after having been on safari. In other circumstances, Ayers might have made a sarcastic comment about the good old days when they drank river water that they'd purified themselves with iodine tablets and stayed at a hotel in Borneo where the sheets were crawling with tiny golden ants.
We've been expecting your call for over a week,
her mother again. In the background, Ayers hears the cork pop. The mere sound makes her stomach lurch, and the tubes singing Talk to You Later, Phil and Sunny's favorite song, straight out of the early 80s. Ayers's eyes water. Despite the fact that she can't remember the last time she saw her parents, Ayers knows them well. They're her family. But why were they expecting her call? She never calls them. It's always the other way around.
You have?
There's something you want to tell us. Isn't there, Freddy?
It's her father again. Freddy is their nickname for Ayers. It's short for Ready Freddy, which was apparently what Ayers said nonstop when she was little.
I do,
Ayers says.
You're engaged!
Her mother blurts it out. The champagne must have gone to her head already.
Mick sent us a Facebook message asking for our blessing.
He did? Ayers says. She's taken aback by this news. Mick has met Phil and Sunny 3 times, the 2 times they swung through St. John to visit, and then at Ayers' cousin's destination wedding in San Juan. Phil and Sunny like Mick. Phil and Mick are both craft beer fanatics, and they have a friendly rivalry in the sunset picture-taking department. #sunset. Ayers doesn't miss this habit of Mick's one bit.
Mick won Sunny over by dancing with her at Brinley's wedding and by agreeing to tour Castillo San Cristobal at 7 o'clock the next morning. But even so, asking for her parents' blessing isn't something Ayers ever thought Mick would do. It seems too formal and old-fashioned. It also seems unfair. If Mick was so vested in the engagement, why did he blow it less than 2 days later? Who does that?
When we did an overnight in the Maasai village, Sunny says, we told the elder that our daughter was getting married, and he insisted on roasting a goat, which is a very big honor.
Ayers falls face down across her bed. Mick asked for her parents' blessing without her knowledge. Her parents celebrated her engagement with Maasai villagers without even hearing if she'd said yes, which feels vaguely dishonest of them. Just like intimating they wrote a travel blog. And yet this is typical of her parents. When they travel, living is done in the moment. The strangers they're with become friends. The particulars of their lives can be stretched and even distorted without any consequence because tomorrow they'll be gone. Ayers lifts her head from the bed.
Why didn't you call me? She asks. You had goat with the Maasai, but you didn't call to say congratulations?
It was your news to share, Phil says. We've been waiting for this call. Frankly, it took so long that we began to wonder if something had happened.
Ayers hesitates. She feels bad about ruining her parents' happy champagne drinking.
Something did happen.
Maya saw Mick kissing Bridget a couple days after he proposed. I gave the ring back. On the other end, there's silence. Who has the phone now? Did they drop it? Ayers can ever so faintly hear Fee Waybill sing, I'll just see you around.
Mom, Ayers says. Dad?
Sorry, Fred. It's just we're... Phil says. He clears his throat. The Maasai assured us killing the goat would mean a long and happy union.
The goat lies, Ayers thinks.
Darn it, Sunny says. I liked Michael.
I liked him too, Mom, Ayers says. But I'm not going to stay with someone who cheats on me. Sorry.
She pauses.
Anyway, I have more news, and I'm sure it will come as an even bigger shock, so sit down.
Go ahead, Freddy, Phil says. Your mother says she needs her drink.
Yes, Ayers thinks. Yes, she does.
I'm pregnant.
She's pregnant, Phil shouts.
In the background, Sunny shrieks.
But wait,
Ayers says, and she silently curses Mick for being thoughtful enough to contact her parents and despicable enough to cheat on Ayers 2 days later.
It's not Mick's baby.
It's not?
Her mother. What do you mean? Whose baby is it?
Mom, stay on the phone, please.
They always do this, pass the phone back and forth like they're playing a game of hot potato.
I'll explain it to you and you can explain it to Dad.
Ayers rolls onto her back. The spinning ceiling fan above makes her nauseated, so she closes her eyes.
While Mick and I were broken up, I met a man named Baker Steele.
Baker Steele? Sunny says. That sounds like a name from a soap opera. Baker Steele.
I liked him a lot, but he lived in Houston.
And you don't date tourists.
That's right. But he has family ties here, so he came back, and I slept with him, and now I'm pregnant.
Oh, Freddy, Sunny says. I haven't talked to Baker about it yet, but I